June Seaman, Reel 3.
Well, I hadn't got my gas mask with me. We never had the chance to read orders. We never read camp orders. It didn't apply to us. We were 50 feet underground. So there was everybody walking around with their gas mask on, and I didn't. And I came face to face with the man, the sergeant, who was in charge of all the gas masks. We hadn't had any gas attacks. Nobody ever thought we had. But still, it said he had to have a little hut in the middle of the woods surrounding Bentley Priory. Where's your gas mask? I said, I haven't got it. You should read company orders. Station orders, that was it. Not company orders, station orders. I said, but we never see station orders. You should see station orders. By that time, it was, gas thing was over. I went and got my things from Warrant Officer Brimblecombe, which she didn't say anything, thank goodness. And I can't remember the flight sergeant's name, the man. He said, come and see me at my in my hut at 6 o'clock this evening. So I said, well, I'm on duty at 7. By that time, I was living at home, but that's another story. I'll tell you that later. And I had to cycle 4 miles. I don't care. You come and see me at 6 o'clock that evening. So I had to leave early, and I reported him in his hut. First thing he said to me was, where's your gas mask? I said, you didn't tell me to bring my gas mask. You should know if you come here, you need your gas mask. Come and see me again tomorrow. And I thought, no, this is too much. So again, I went to our lovely flight sergeant and I said to him, look, this is what's happening. It's not my fault at all. And I feel I'm being penalised, one thing or the other. And later on in that watch, he said to me, it's all right. I've made it all right. You don't have to go. So you see how he really was. You've got the nice NCOs and the horrible ones. But they're doing all sorts of life, really. It was just they had that certain amount of power.
And also that you had that rather sort of different status, it would seem. Am I right?
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it was right. We were doing very important jobs. We couldn't be treated. I mean, it's really like the stars of the Royal Ballet are treated. You know, all right, they're nice, ordinary, normal human beings. But sometimes you've got to say, oh, yeah, well, let's go a bit easy, you know, because they are doing a job of work and the same as we were.
It was interesting earlier on, Joan, you were saying how things altered when the Americans came in. Why was that?
Well, we had more. That was really the reason. We had more people on this is we didn't see
on the board.
Yes. We didn't see, there was no more in the operations room, but because WAX came over, they did some jobs that the WAF used to do. So therefore there were, and they took over some aerodromes, which released the WAF. I mean, some WAF came to us from sectors. And that was really quite funny because they were saying, where's the aerodromes? Oh, this is boring. Where's the aerodromes? And then I remember one girl saying, my goodness, those planes, they're heading straight for us, because you could see on the map, you see, when they were heading for us. And we sort of said, oh, yes. And she didn't last very long. She couldn't stand the strain. It was all right, just a small aerodrome, but she couldn't stand that. So this is the reason why. We didn't have really anything to do, or at least very, very little to do with the American Air Force actually on the camp. We just saw one or two of the officers around. A few of the WACs that did have a line of communication from our place, we got on quite well with. I remember I saw the razor cut for the first time, which is the sort of way of cutting hair. We thought that was great.
You mentioned earlier the use of teleprinters. Were you involved with teleprinters?
Yes, we all had to take it in turns to use the teleprinters as well as plotting. And there was one particular incident I do remember about the misuse, really, of teleprinters. And I remember it, but I didn't see the sequel to it because it was my birthday. And I had permission to leave a little bit early because of all things I was going to the ballet for a matinee. And when I left, there was a couple of hostile aeroplanes that were making their way over to overland. And when I got back that evening, there was a terrific flap on, and I was questioned. Was I there? No, and I had authority to go, so I was let off the hook, but I had to be in waiting. And it transpired from the inquiry that the teleprinter had come through, and there were two middle-aged men on working this teleprinter, and the track had split, and they only had plotted one track. And a beautiful, neat track, which was their want, you know, perfect, but they had omitted from the teleprinter to do the other track. And that was when the school at Lewisham, which is quite famous, was bombed with no warning. They hushed it up, and in the questions were asked in Parliament, and it was, I forget which excuse was made, but nothing ever was laid at the door of the operations room. The only thing was those two men were taken off duty in the operations room, and they were put into the orderly room. And oddly enough, one became a sergeant in the orderly room. So that is really my memory of the teleprinter from the Royal Observer Corps.
When you look back at that time, you know, with all your experience in the plotting room and this great responsibility, do you have any idea how effective that system was in the...
Well, yes, it was effective, certainly in the sector, because that guided the actual aeroplanes. And the group, they could say which squadrons to come up. Our particular job, I think, was to give a picture to whoever came, to give the whole picture. This is why we had so many people came to see us, visiting Royalty. I don't know half of them, because some of them came, of course, when I wasn't on duty. And some of them, when I had my headphones on, and you couldn't think about anything if you had your headphones on. But it really was to give a complete picture of everything that was going on around the shores of the British Isles.
And do you think you gave that complete
picture? Oh, yes. Yes. Well, we couldn't be off it if we... the flight sergeant could ring, could pick up the phone and listen to our plots. And if anybody was missing plots, my goodness, you were out. But you didn't. You felt a sense of responsibility. You automatically, it wasn't the threat of him doing that at all.
Can you ever remember an occasion when you found it very difficult to keep pace with what was going on?
In all honesty, no. Mind you, I was very young, you see.
You're saying
19
D-day.
To 20.
Yes.
Now, D-Day was exciting. It was extremely exciting. I was on duty from, it was a three watch day, I think, because perhaps somebody was on leave or something or other, because we didn't normally work from three watches. And I was on from 8 to 1 o'clock, and things were happening. There was a buzz. And I was living at home then, because that was something else. When the Americans came in, hostels were at a premium. And so anybody who wanted to live at home could. And I lived 4 miles away at Pinner. And I used to cycle up 4 miles there and back. When I think of it now in the blackout, and we're scared to walk down the road now, you know, it's ridiculous. Anyway, and I went back again at 7 o'clock, and I was put on messenger, which meant I sat by the lamps and tube and just went around everywhere. It was pandemonium, absolute pandemonium. I butted Air Chief Marshal Harris in the stomach, going up 2 stairs as he was coming down, and I recoiled in horror, and all he did was laugh about it. It's quite indescribable because everything was going full blast. On the table, we plotted convoys, just a circle of cardboard with the convoy name on it. Well, there was just four circles in an enormous square with a sort of little plaque in the middle, and I can't remember what was on the plaque, but it was a code name, and that was all the ships going over. I mean, there was so much. It was just the whole plotting table was just a complete mass of coloured arrows. Complete mass of it. And my whole impression is just everybody charging around at speed. Of course, we were relieved at midnight, and I cycled home, and I went to bed. My mother always woke up. And she said, "Everything all right, Joan?" And I said, "Yes." And I went up to bed. And the next morning at 8 o'clock, I was screaming from my mother down below, "Joan, the invasion started." And I said, "I know." And she said, "Of course you do, of course you do." And she brought me up the week's ration of egg and bacon in bed. And we've always said that I did the invasion completely single-handed, according to my mother. And my brother sunk the Scharnhorst because he was in the bombing raid that sunk the Scharnhorst. We always said that. Anyway, then I went on duty at 1 o'clock, 1 to 7, and that was when I was on 11 Group and the King came and everything. But you had to concentrate so much when you were on 11 Group. You didn't have any time for anything at all around you. And it just sort of went on, you know, with that. I remember, too, how sad we were about Arnhem, which we couldn't do anything about it. We couldn't send any aeroplanes over because the weather was so bad, and the frustration of everybody felt it, of just sitting there and knowing what was happening, and we couldn't send anything because, I mean, I think it was bad planning anyway, but that was something I've learnt from my history book since, you know. At that time, it was just sheer frustration. And
I suppose it would have been the case sometimes that you would have had people plotting and knowing that their dear ones were sort of involved in these planes.
Oh,
did that?
Yes, yes. But you had to forget that. They weren't people, they were arrows. Because sometimes, not so much a D-Day, but other times there was one hostile plane, arrow, and another hostile plane, arrow. And then you only got the next plot on one track, not two tracks. So you knew that one was killed. But if you started to think about that, you'd go mad. They were arrows. And in fact, when we had a little minor blitz in 1943, which wasn't anything very much, I had an American boyfriend at the time, and he said, "Oh, do you want to go in? We were in Piccadilly." And I was looking up, and I said, "Oh, no, no, no." They weren't real to me then. They were arrows on a map. It's quite amazing how you thought of that.
It was interesting, you know, saying about the King coming and Mrs. Roosevelt as well. Did you have other VIPs?
Yes, James Cagney. I do remember him passing me and saying, "Gee, wow," just like that. I can't actually remember any more actual people, but we got quite blasé. Oh, yes, we did have Group Captain Winterbottom at some time, because his future wife was one of our friends, and apparently he met her. He watched her plotting. I only came in when he was, as I say, going with her at the time. But I do remember her quite well. I only saw him once. I don't think he actually... I don't remember him in the ops room, but what I do remember is meeting him socially at a dance. That's when we met everybody's boyfriends and that sort of thing then.
I suppose you wouldn't have known his role in Ultra.
No,
at that time.
Not a thing. Or we knew that something was... Something was going on at Bletchley Park. And we had no idea what it was. It was only after the war we found out about Enigma and everything like that. No, no, no. There was absolutely nothing at all about that. There was just two or three officers that were in direct liaison with them. And particularly with the flying bombs and the V2s, we had to give them every bit of information about where they landed and that sort of thing. I do remember that, but I don't. That was secret, which we knew there was something, but what it was, didn't know at all.
Yes. Talking of dances, I wonder what your social life would have been like in the war. You know, here you are, you've got an American boyfriend at one time.
Yes. Well, the thing was, it was quite funny. Covent Garden, the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, was then a dance hall. And we used to go there. And I think I danced with the United Nations. Completely and utterly. I had an American boyfriend for a time, but I had loads of boyfriends, you know. Nothing was serious. He would have liked to have been serious. And he was a lovely man, Steve Sulek. I even remember his name, from New Jersey. And his mother sent me a whole lot of Max Factor cosmetics, nail varnish and that. I was the envy of every girl on the watch. I really was. It was absolutely. But my best friend got engaged to an American. She met him in the blackout in Piccadilly, though they came from Baltimore, he came from Baltimore, and they, to this day, have never told his mother. They said that they met at a services club. Never that she fell over in the blackout and he helped her up, took her to Piccadilly Station, and then said, "Can I see you again?" Yes. So, there was a lot of intermingling, but nothing.
Did the Americans bring anything different to England, do you think, when they came?
Yes, brashness. The fact that they were coming to save democracy. And we all felt very angry about it. They all had far more money than we did. Far more money. And they really thought that, I mean, their canteen, their PX is so different to our Neffy. Oh, I mean, and yet they thought they were coming to save democracy. And they'd never been. I think in a film, now this is where a film is good, The Way to the Stars, that film, I think the most telling point of it is when John Mills is a pilot. I think a bomb pilot, who is doing ground duties. And the Americans come in, and the man, Bona Kalina, I can remember the actor's name, and he is taking over John Mills' room. And he says, "Oh, we've come over to save you, you know, it'll be all right now," and that sort of thing, and you people, and I suppose you're on the ground staff. And John Mills sort of says nothing until he takes his jacket off the peg to take it into another room, and there he's got his pilot wings and a DSO and a DFC on it. And Bernicolino looks as if the ground could swallow him up. I think they were ignorant more than that, but they still are about the war. I mean, I have American relatives, and a 14-year-old boy asked me a couple of years ago, "I've always wanted to know, did you come in on our side during the war?" So, the ignorance is there. A lot of the girls absolutely fell for them because they had all the material things that we couldn't get, and I didn't blame them in the slightest. I'm not saying that, you know, they were all the same. Some of them were very nice, but the majority of them, we did feel very resentful because they had come in halfway through the war. They'd never experienced bombing, nothing. And of course, the RAF did all the night bombing, and they did all the daytime bombing, because the nighttime bombing, they needed more experience. They tried them on nighttime, but there were so many casualties because they didn't have the experience. So they had the nighttime, they had the daytime bombing. And when I was on leave, I used to go on leave down at Bournemouth with some friends because, you know, it was always a good time to be had down in Bournemouth. And we used to get these American, you know, at dances and taking us out, taking us home, out to dinner and that. And, oh, the lines they used to shoot about where they were. And we said, really? Oh, dear. We knew so well that they were talking absolute rubbish. Which is quite funny, really.
Did you meet any black Americans?
No. None at all. But I can tell you where I was suddenly conscious of colour prejudice in myself, and I think it gave me a very good lesson. I was waiting to be served my meal in a hostel in Stanmore, and there was a very pretty, she wasn't black, she was a brown girl, and she was dishing that, and I thought, oh, what a pity that she really can't do all the things that I do. She won't be able to have these boyfriends around the place. And I suddenly stopped dead, and I thought, why not? Why not? She is the same as me. It's just her skin's different. Why am I thinking this? That she's different because she's off to different kind of thing. Why can't she go out and do this sort of thing? And that absolutely cured me of any racist feeling at all. And I can really put my hand on my heart and say, you know, people can be black, green, white, purple, you know, it doesn't make any difference to me. So that was quite a salutary lesson I learnt during the war.
Now, regarding the Americans, you know, keeping to Americans, do you think they made much difference on English culture at that time? You know, one hears of sort of Glenn Miller and the tunes. Do you think yourself?
Well, I'm in rather a different position to an ordinary person. Having played in dance bands for many years and having on and off, you know, oh, and I was playing by that time too, the Skyrockets dance band was at Bentley Priory and at Stanmore, and I was their relief pianist when I could get off. So, you know, that was, I was there. And I played so many Glenn Miller arrangements, and I thought Vera Lynn and Gracie Fields were the absolute pits because they were square and everything. It was Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, who are better musicians. You see, I've got a musician's idea of that. But George Shearing, the blind pianist, I mean, I listened to him and he lived at Pinner and I used to see him sometimes. Even now, I mean, I recorded the thing on tape that he had an omnibus on him. And I think he's just one of the greatest things out, you know. But I've got a different idea. I'm not typical. You know, people used to sing the songs from the latest films in the bus and that, and I used to sing them wrong, and I thought, oh, dear, you know. But that's something you have to live with if you're a musician. You've got to realise that people don't have the same sort of ears as you. So I don't think. Yes, well, of course, it was the music, but
How about jitterbugging as well? Did that come in?
Yes, all that. But it's still, we'd seen it on films before, so it wasn't actually brought over by them. I think the films brought it more than the Americans, and the Americans reinforced it. But it wasn't brought over by the Americans. We were aware of it before then. I mean, and I was playing Glenn Miller orchestrations before the Americans came over. You know, and the Duke Ellington orchestrations. And we were terribly aware. I mean, and Benny Goodman was the greatest clarinetist that ever lived. And I think he was a very good one, even now. So, you know, that all happened. But I think the majority of service people still thought Vera Lynn and that sort of thing was still the greatest. I get very quiet about Vera Lynn. Now I realise what a wonderful person she was. And what a difference she made to so many people, and sincerity in her voice. But as a young person in my early 20s, she was not my sort of music. It is quite other. The films, of course, were great, great influence.
How about radio programmes?
Oh, yes, though I didn't hear so many then, because I was too busy.
But did you have any favourites?
Do you know, I can't remember then when I was in the WEF. Before then, when I was at home, it was the Gang Show and Itmar, of course.
What was Itmar?
It's That Man Again with Tommy Handley, and they had all the catchphrases. Ta-ta for now, and this is Fumph speaking, and those sort of things. But no, in the Air Force, we had gramophones and we played jazz and, you know, and the Glenn Miller and that sort of thing. Didn't really listen. We didn't have time to listen to radio programmes.
Did you find, you know, while we're on this sort of subject of recreation, that, you know, obviously young men and women were thrown together in the blackout, like your friend. Yes. Do you think yourself that sort of sexual mores altered in World War II?
No, I don't. There were girls who slept with Americans for what they could get out of them. Not necessarily money, you know. But the majority didn't. No, it wasn't. I didn't find it so. But that may be because I was so busy doing other things. You see, talking about culture, this is when I started to go to the ballet. This is when I found my real love of it. There used to be a kiosk in Trafalgar Square where you could get tickets, forces tickets, on the day. And on night duty, when we didn't have to be on duty till midnight, we used to go up at 10 o'clock, get tickets, go back, stand on the tube, have a few hours sleep and come to the performance in the evening. And one day we said, my friend and I, it was another Joan, said, let's try this ballet. I had been playing the course for ballet classes since I was 14 and I'd seen one or two, but it didn't hit me. And we got tickets for the Sadler's Wells Ballet, who was then having a season at the New Theatre. I heard the weekend that some very famous ex-ballerina said, Pamela May said, and we did it to two pianos. And I thought, no, not at the New Theatre. You had an orchestra there. I didn't contradict her, but I confirmed it afterwards. Anyway, and it happened to be Fontaine and Helpman's Swan Lake. And we loved it. And the next time we thought, well, let's try this ballet again. And it was Swan Lake. But it was another company in another theatre called the International Company with Mona Inglesby, who was a very rich daughter of a very rich man who'd rather bought Clover Valley Company. And I remembered we looked at each other in the interval and we said, this isn't the same. Oh, my goodness, this is not anywhere near not the same. From then on, I was hooked. And I used to go an awful lot to the ballet, every chance I could. And, of course, the Olivia seasons at the New Theatre, too. I saw his Richard III on stage and his Hotspur and Ralph Richardson, all those lovely, wonderful old productions.
And did the Forces, did you have cheaper tickets then?
Yes, we did. I can't really remember exactly how much cheaper they were, but they were, if they were available. But it wasn't really expensive, not comparatively so. No, I mean it's my theatre-going habit started, and an awful lot of people, as I found out from this conference I've been to just this past weekend, a lot of people had said exactly the same, that those new theatre seasons of the old Vic and Sadler's Wells Theatre, Sir Bronson Aubrey, it's now the Aubrey Theatre actually, he lent this theatre to the old Vic because I think Sadler's Wells was a hostel and I think the old Vic had been bombed. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, they were unavailable. So that's where an awful lot of people form their theatre-going habits there.
How about INSA? Did you have anything to do with INSA in the war?
Not in the war. After the war, when the ops room had closed down and I was in charge of the entertainment's office and that sort of thing, and it ranged from the horrible to the good. But, of course, being near London, we didn't have many ENSA places. I mean, they had the value of going to outlandish places, you know. So I can't really make any pronouncements on ENSA. I didn't really see enough of it. I just remember once after the war when somebody called Bill Murray was helping. We worked the lights and it was the dimmers, a real old-fashioned thing, not these computer things now. And he said, let's give a moonlight effect on this singer coming on, a really stately soprano. And so we got this wonderful moonlight effect and she walked on and she announced she was going to sing a song called O Rising Sun. We nearly died. But it was that sort of thing, you know, it wasn't. But I really can't speak with any authority on it at all. I didn't have enough to do with it.
Mm. When you left plotting, was that because the need had gone?
Yes. Well, the ops room closed down.
And when did it close down?
Just at the end of the war. Well, perhaps a week or so before. That was all. You know, we carried on. I mean, things got very, very, I won't say lax exactly, that's wrong. But everybody was looking for other things. But by that time, we had the Bentley Players. And the Bentley Players was a dramatic society run by people in there, and we were all professional artists in some form or other. We had a woman who was the a teacher of the League of Health and Beauty, for example. We had who helped with all the dances and that sort of thing. We had a professional stage manager who was stage manager of the Coventry Hippodrome in real life. We also had a dentist, all sorts of people. But we were either on the stage crew or we were acting shows. And we did all sorts of things, and we toured the local aerodromes and Woolwich Garrison Theatre, we did Shenley Military Hospital up at York, we went, but that was after the war. We had to sort of fit it in, but we could fit it in, you know. I mean, by that time things were relaxed. As I say, when the V2s were on, we were, as I've said, in the Scala Theatre when Bentley Players brought the house down. Yes, I haven't said about the V2s. V1s. That really was quite important, because we had a little directive round.